Stay tuned for a very special In Other News.
In other news.
To determine why and how the towers collapsed.
Scary to have this helicopter hovering around.
You walk up to them and confront them. They can't stand that.
Welcome to Another News, and thank you, Reggie. This is a special two-hour In Other News show. I'm Jeff Brady, and we'll be talking about several very sensitive topics, often folded amid lies, half-truths, and the religion of science. The topics include the events that occurred on September 11, 2001 in the United States, specifically the research of Dr. Judy Wood for her book, Where Did the Towers Go? Evidence of Directed Free Energy Technology on 9/11. This book outlines irrefutable evidence of a directed energy technology used to break apart the World Trade Center towers and Building 7 on that day. Another area we've also been lied to about by the so-called progressive media, or the media tasked with the responsibility to deliver real news, is geoengineering or climate engineering, aerosol operations, solar radiation management, stratospheric aerosol operations. This is a technology currently deployed in real time, meaning right now, all the time, to manipulate and control weather and create violent weather. Reporting on this, truthfully, is neither a right or left wing agenda. This is very possibly a trillion-dollar operation and is part of a military agenda termed full-spectrum dominance. We'll also talk about the United Nations agenda for the 21st century, a global plan creeping into regions of the U.S. and North America. Remember past guests Rosa Corey and Stacy Lynn talking about ICLEI, the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives? It's tasked with carrying out the goals of UN Agenda 21 locally using taxpayer money. That was back in 2012, and people were noticing back then how millions in taxpayer revenue were used to fund ICLEI initiatives. Now think about the foreign real estate investment that's occurring in North America. The erasure of jurisdictional boundaries is done under the guise of environmentalism. Remember the use of those words we talked about, the ones that leave you with a positive feeling, a must-be-okay feeling. They include smart, livable, walkable, vibrant, bikeable, progressive, carbon footprint, vision, green, sustainable. Smart, I think, is the most overused. Smart appliances, smart meters, smart water, smart cars. There are people in think tanks designing your future. They would like you to think in a scarcity mindset, to live in an ultra-small living space, to be bathed in microwave radiation, to accept being spied on, not only by your personal digital communication device, but your appliances. And if you look closely, you can already see the beginnings of the world being prepared for generations to come. Normalized weather control technology, suppressed free energy, biometrics, and transhumanism. We're joined today by Andrew Johnson, who is a former software engineer and a special education teacher. He runs the site checktheevidence.com. He's the author of the book 9/11, Finding the Truth, which is a free download at his site. Andrew has done extensive research into the destruction that occurred on September 11, 2001, the manufactured wars on terror, the suppression of free energy and climate engineering. He also brought Dr. Judy Wood to the UK. Andrew, welcome back to Another News.
Well, thank you very much, Jeff, for organizing this program, and thanks to WBAI for having the bravery to actually discuss these topics, which, as you said, are very sensitive. And also, perhaps we should mention the other guests that we've got with us this afternoon, who I think will only be available for roughly the first hour of the program. So,
indeed, yeah, we're joined also by attorney Jerry Lepart, who represented Dr. Judy Wood in her QTAM case.
Good afternoon, Jeff, and good afternoon, Andrew. It's good to be here joining you on this broadcast.
Welcome to the show. Well, let's start with Andrew. Andrew, you visited Dr. Judy Wood recently in South Carolina, is it?
Right.
And again, she's the author of Where Did the Towers Go? And she's a frequent guest on the show. How is she doing?
She's doing very well, yes. The reason why I'm in New York, some people might be asking that question, how can I be here? Well, actually, what I decided to do last year was come and see the eclipse, because there's been a, as most people should know, there's been a solar eclipse which did achieve totality in certain parts of North America. And I actually found that out by accident in about 2016. Oddly, the path of totality went right over where Dr. Judy Wood was living. It went right over her house. And I found that out by accident. So I discussed with her that we needed to watch this together, and that's what we did. So I went to her house last week, you know, set that all up in advance. She had some neighbours, and we actually had a rental house. I was very tired because I'd driven down from Charlotte Airport down to where Dr. Wood lives, having had a very long journey over from the UK. And then I got to the house at about midnight US time, so I'd been awake for nearly 24 hours and driven about 120 miles. And then I got up the next day to drive to Dr. Wood's house to pick her up to bring her back to the rental house that we'd rented, which is a lovely house. We had a magnificent view of the eclipse. I'm going to try and make a YouTube video so that people can see the picture that I took. And her neighbours, unfortunately, missed the eclipse because there was cloud around. We just got a break in the cloud, and we witnessed the whole thing. But unfortunately, her neighbours missed it. So it was very fortunate that we decided to come over and you know, bring her over to the house where we were, because none of us would have seen it if we'd gone to where she was.
That's a close one.
So it was. And there are various coincidences of timing, which I won't go into here. But just to explain that, as you mentioned, I've done a lot of research into 9/11, my background, software engineering. I don't actually work in special education as such, but my work was previously related to special education. I am a tutor for the Open University, which is basically a university that operates in the UK and does distance learning courses. And I've worked for them for it's about 15 years now.
Thanks for clarifying
that. That's okay. And so that's given me a lot of latitude. In other words, I don't really have a boss. I don't work in an office. I work at home. And that essentially is what has allowed me to unpick some of the topics that you know, included in the introduction, and how ultimately I came into contact with Dr. Wood and Jerry Leaphart, who is here with us today. So the 9/11 research that Dr. Wood did was very much evidence-based, completely evidence-based. For that reason, in 2006, I think it was, Jerry, that's when you got in touch with Dr. Wood because of the evidential basis of her research, wasn't it?
That's correct. That's my recollection of the date and the timing, Andrew. And at the time, I was a practicing lawyer. I've been referred to as an activist lawyer, and at that stage in my career, many of my cases, a lot of my litigation work did center on what might be termed activist causes, and I was impressed with the quality of the research that Dr. Wood had done, and I was able to meet with her in 2006, if I recall correctly, and out of those discussions, we were able to come upon an approach of filing a request for correction, it's the name of the document, with the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which at that time had been tasked with determining what caused the Twin Towers to be destroyed. That's not the exact
you got to get it right.
Phrase.
You know, if Dr. Wood was here, she would say, "Oh, wait a minute, that's not correct."
Yes, she would.
I have a clip of her talking about that, and let me just play a few minutes of that clip.
Sure.
So the listeners have a little bit more context.
Can you explain what NIST is?
National Institute of Standard and National Institute of Standards and Technology. Congress mandated NIST to determine why and how the towers collapsed. And they produced this 10,000-page report with everything but that information in it. They produced hypothetical models of possibilities and so forth, but they didn't study what happened to the buildings when they quit standing.
Right. And you also point out that they used the word collapse, which is fundamentally wrong to even say that's what happened.
Right. They didn't determine it was a collapse. And so I wrote to them after their report came out and submitted a request for correction, stating what I felt were, you know, horrendous errors or oversight in their report, beginning with the title of their report, because they hadn't determined it was a collapse. At one point, I pointed out that some scenario, hypothetical scenario they showed, violated the laws of physics. And they said, oh, no, it doesn't, because we didn't analyze the collapse. So, we can't have something that our collapse analysis can't violate the laws of physics because it doesn't exist. So right there, they admitted that they did not analyze the destruction of the buildings.
And can you connect this to your whistleblower case?
Yes, this is what qualified me for the whistleblower case. I was the first on record to blow the whistle on the NIST report about the demise of the buildings. And that qualifies me as a whistleblower to file a federal QI-TAM case, which I did a month later.
I don't even know what a QI-TAM is. What is that?
Maybe you should have my lawyer on to explain it more in detail.
So that's Latin, obviously, right?
Yeah, QUITAM.
Okay.
But it's known casually as a whistleblower case.
I got you. Okay.
And you don't sue the government, but you sue the contractors who committed science fraud.
Science fraud, and that's what the whistleblower case was about.
Yes.
Suing the contractors for fraud.
They defrauded taxpayers because they were paid with taxpayer money to help prepare the NIST report and do various models and analysis.
And what happened?
Of course, with the opposition, the defendants in the case are a significant portion of the military-industrial complex. And they have a bank of lawyers who wants to find any way possible to get this tossed out before it moves forward to discovery. They try every, thing possible. The judge had various comments. There's a lot of different comments, but some of the ones that I remember are he wasn't going to hear a case about who shot JFK or what landed on the moon. But this case wasn't about those things. This is about fraud. It's not about who done it. None of my filings is there anything about, finger pointing as to who committed the acts of 9/11. I'm talking about who was responsible for determining why and how the towers collapsed in a scientific study. For example, Underwriter's lab made 4 mock-ups of the floor. 2 were full-scale and 2 were half-scale. They set them on fire for, twice the temperature in degrees Fahrenheit for twice as long, and they did not fail to support load. So they had to call the test because they didn't fail. Yet they signed off in a report saying that fire did it, but they could not get fire to do it. That's fraud.
That is fraud. Classic case of fraud. And the judge had this evidence before him.
He didn't look at the evidence. He also ignored my request for correction, which was the basis of my case. Pretend it didn't exist.
The basis for you wanted the contractor to correct the experiment.
My act of whistleblowing was the basis of my case.
Mm-hmm.
If my act of whistleblowing is ignored, I've got no evidence. Ignoring the evidence I submitted. The judges, you have to feel for them. If this case went forth, like even at the lower court, if this case went forth, can you imagine, all the guns on, aimed at the judge?
Who allowed it to do that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Even if it just went forward to discovery. You have to understand the position that the judges are in.
And you explained it briefly in that if a judge allowed that case to go forward, then they would be under a lot of pressure and may affect their career.
After the lower court decision, we appealed it to a higher court. And there's 3 judges for that, and they had like 8-minute, I think, hearing. You don't really cover anything. I think they just want to meet you. Meanwhile, there was a restatement of the law emphasizing the accountability issue, which is what the law was intended for, and the courts had misunderstood the law and misinterpreted it and so forth and gotten off base.
Mm-hmm.
But with all of the bailouts, they were restating this law because they wanted accountability for fraud in the system. The judges, three judges in that case, I think it was very respectful of them to put it in the footnote that they were ignoring that law to dismiss the case.
And I guess they're allowed to do that?
It's my understanding that the question is, can a judge, whatever follows after that, the answer is yes. And we appeal it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court doesn't have to hear cases, just only if they feel like it. And I think it's about 5% of the cases they actually hear.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was denied. They don't have to give a reason. They just don't want to, you know, touch it. They call it 10-foot pole syndrome.
Okay, that was a clip from past interview with Dr. Judy Wood talking about the Ketem case, and we're here in the studio with Andrew Johnson, and Andrew is actually brought the Dr. Judy Wood's lawyer in here who represented her in the Ketem case. Jerry, can you describe a little more detail about the defrauded the government part of that case?
Okay. Well, first of all, Dr. Wood's presentation of the case that was just aired was very well done, and it actually, for me, brought back the very pleasant memory of having a working relationship with Judy during the entire course of the case and the proceedings, starting with before the request for correction was filed with NIST. All the way through to, as Judy remarked, having the case denied at the level of the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, the theory of the case is that we sued contractors who had been retained by NIST to basically carry out the investigation of what caused the destruction of the World Trade Center. And as Judy remarked, NIST admitted to us that, well, they didn't do that. It was science fraud in the classical sense that you phrase the question so that you do not have to answer that which you are charged with answering. That's why we termed it as fraud. Another phrase that found support in the law that we relied on was willful blindness. You know, you can't pretend that you are addressing the issue and the question that you're being paid for on the one hand and then turn away on the other as if you did not see it. We've used the term contractors. Well, who are we talking about? Well, basically, we're talking about the cream of the crop of the military-industrial complex. These are the companies that actually make the weapons and demonstrate the kind of technology that was shown to have been involved on 9/11.
Dr. Judy Wood.
By Dr. Judy Wood, correct. So that to us was just the straw that broke the camel's back. You have NIST pretending that they don't know what happened and are not therefore investigating it. The companies that included Science Applications International Corp., SAIC, and
ARA,
Applied Research Associates, headquartered in Albuquerque, New Mexico, right next to the military-industrial complex
sites. White Sands,
the missile testing. This is what they do. They make these weapons. And equally important, they also test the lethality effects so that these are the companies that when they see an explosion, that for them is their work. They have to assess and know how to assess the effects of something that has been destroyed by an application of energy of one sort or another. That is what they do. And so for us, it added insult to injury to have this 10,000-page report that explained everything except what happened, and then to have a footnote in the report that literally said, well, we didn't investigate that. The investigation stops at the point that the destruction is beginning to take place.
That's what's said in a letter from, the name is Catherine Fletcher. She wrote this letter to Dr. Judy Wood when you were pressing them on this issue, weren't you? And she actually said that we only investigated the events up to the point of collapse, quote unquote.
Right. And because that letter was addressed to Judy, that, in our view, made her the original source of the information that that is what happened. And we knew who did it because we knew that SAIC and ARA, among other companies, were in actually doing the investigation, and they actually led it, as in the nature of what is termed public-private partnerships, where a governmental entity that actually has the responsibility to do a task basically turns it over to private contractors, and they run it. And SAIC literally ran this investigation and indicated what would be done, what would not be done, what would be looked at, what would not be looked at. That, to us, was fraud.
At this point, you're working with Dr. Wood. This is 10 years ago. Why are you thinking, why am I involved in this? This is, the judge is going to throw this out. What were you thinking?
Yes, we knew that a judge would be hard-pressed to allow this case to go forward. Our task was to present it as a legal case with as much consistency, with as much evidence, and with as much legal validity as we could, so as to make it as difficult as possible for a judge to do what a judge was most likely going to do. After all, we were accusing SAIC and ARA of knowing that the World Trade Center was destroyed with directed energy weaponry. So it was going to be very difficult to get that to go forward. Now, almost all lawyers who represented 9/11 cases, including that of April Gillespie, were sanctioned or penalized for having engaged in the representation. Many were required to pay costs, to pay court costs. No one on the Dr. Judy Wood case was put into that position. Now, for one reason, we had an enormous amount of evidence. You could not easily say that we had no basis for bringing this case. We did. One of the more interesting pieces of evidence that we had was, in addition to the letter from Catherine Fletcher, we also had a letter from the United States Directed Energy Directorate located in Albuquerque, New Mexico. That is the entity that manages the stockpile of directed energy weapons. These are weapons that exist. And have existed for quite some time. And the Directed Energy Directorate manages them.
Incredible. These are weapons that turn matter into dust. Probably doesn't leave a lot of radiation fallout.
Well, I mean, going back to that letter, as I recall, Jerry, it was the name of the public relations officer was Rich Garcia, and he's one of these people that's popped up on various documentaries about HAARP and things like this. I've seen him on one or two documentaries. And the difficulty was that the directed energy weapons which were used to destroy the World Trade Center, that is what is established in Dr. Wood's research in the book, Where Did the Towers Go, in the videos, in the website and so forth. That is the truth. But the directed energy weapons that they want to talk about publicly are generally things like high-energy lasers or masers. And the class of technology, if you read Dr. Wood's book, it's something that is completely black. We have almost no information in the public world about how these weapons work. But Dr. Wood essentially deduced the operation from the book. And some of this evidence, of course, was put into the Ketam case by Jerry. And then we had another chap we should mention just in passing, not that his role is not insignificant, it's very significant, is John Hutchison. Because Jerry and I and Dr. Wood We talked to one another about this, with Jerry obviously leading everything. I ended up actually spending a couple of hours on the phone with John Hutchison writing out an affidavit. I can't even remember how I got to do that, but that's what I did. And Jerry suggested that I too, as I had been involved in the research for a period of time, submit my own affidavit, which was submitted to the court of the Southern District of New York, because I was perfectly willing to come over to the US at my own expense and give evidence if that was what Jerry said that I should do, or, you know, if that's what came about, because I knew, as Jerry did, that what we were dealing with was truth. It wasn't a theory. We could prove what we were saying was true. And of course, in the way that Jerry had described, they knew it was true, because if you read upon the details of what happened, you can tell they know that what we said is true. It's the absolute truth. And so that was their problem.
Jerry, were you concerned at all with any backlash coming your way? And did you get a lot of criticism for being involved?
I did get criticism. Indeed, the written decision in the case criticized both my clients and me for bringing the case. But the distinguishing factor was that the 20 law firms representing the defendants on the other side all applied for sanctions, that is to say that our side of the case, Dr. Wood and I, should pay their costs. They actually filed a motion to that effect, both at the lower court level and at the appellate court level.
How much would that have been?
That would have been many thousands of dollars. Ultimately, I don't know how much it would have been, because the court denied the other side's motions. So, in effect, when you ask, well, what was the outcome of the case? You lost, right? Yes, we lost, and I did not try to build my career on the basis of moral victories. However, in this instance, it was something of a moral victory to be one of the few, in fact, the only one that I know of, the only 9/11 case brought by plaintiffs who were basically challenging the official conspiracy theory explanation. We were the only ones who were not required to pay any costs whatsoever. All such motions were denied. So, and the reason is that you can be made to pay court costs if your case is deemed frivolous. Once again, we were accusing SAIC and ARA of knowing that directed energy weaponry destroyed the World Trade Center. That's what our claim was.
I didn't know that. I thought it was they had defrauded by misrepresenting what had happened in the NIST report.
Well, that's another way of saying it. Because if you know that the basis for destruction is one thing, and you say, well, we're not even going to investigate it, and not say why the
implication,
then that's the fraud. It's the fraud through blindness.
That's pretty courageous of everyone involved here. Is the case dead?
It's the case is over. There are no further legal proceedings that could be had in the ordinary course. Now there might be a way hypothetically to re-raise certain issues in another context or in another forum. I don't know offhand what that would be. You know, virtually all of the documents that were filed in the case, including the request for correction at NIST itself, those are matters of public record. The request for correction is posted up on Department of Commerce's website, and I believe it's still you can still access it. And of course, the book "Where Did the Towers Go?" Dr. Wood's book is the most comprehensive presentation of this matter that is available. However, a good portion of what is in the book, Where Did the Towers Go, and a significant fraction of the photographic evidence found in that book is also filed on record at this website of NIST, an official governmental website, and that's where you can find that evidence to this day. Ultimately, in looking back on this, it may even be to, you know, future generations, one or two generations down the road, when the veil will be lifted over this, and people will be able to overcome the cognitive dissonance that has so far prevented people from looking at this, seeing these two 110-story buildings disintegrate right before their eyes and go from 110 stories to no stories, and know that, you know, that's not an ordinary collapse. No amount of airplane jet fuel, kerosene, can cause that degree of annihilation. And people know that, I think, inherently and intuitively, but we're just not in a position right now where we can look at that.
I was going to ask you, it's 2017, here we are 16 years later. What do you think would make people think about this now?
I don't know, and I don't even know that it will be now. I can tell you that when we were handling the case, we received emails, letters, phone calls from a number of people actually offering support for what we're doing. And Andrew, I don't know about you, but I still get emails fairly regularly with people saying, I see what you did. And thank you. There may come a time, a tipping point, so to speak, when the public is ready to take a look at this and to draw the obvious conclusions from what you can already see.
Andrew, what do you think about the public waking up to this case and maybe bringing it forward? Do you see that happening anytime soon?
Yeah, well, like Jerry said, I do get emails thanking me and Dr. Wood for just, you know, in just the manner that Jerry described. So that's obviously keeps us going. And I mean, when you've been looking at something like this for 16 years, not for myself, but Dr. Wood, she saw the events for what they were pretty much from the get go. Whereas myself, I didn't really start to see anything particularly wrong for about 2 or 3 years after the event. So for myself, it's really about 13 years that I've been out of the sort of influence of the official accounts in one form or another. But moving forward, it's still tough. There has been a good level of people that have come forward under their own initiative. For example, there's an interesting video that people can watch, which is called Irrefutable, which was made by an Australian engineer called Adam Dwyer. And he literally contacted us and said, oh, I've made this video, what do you think? And it's almost like he's done it like a Hollywood production type thing, with the clips from The Matrix, you know, the movie The Matrix, and these sorts of things. And he made an extremely good edit, and it literally, I think, took him about 18 months to do this. And he still wanted to do more, but he had to stop doing it for various reasons. And so it lasts, I think, for about 50 minutes all told. But my point is, in telling people that, is he just did it. He just, you know, he wasn't part of a group. He didn't join 9/11 Truthers, you know, Australia or something. He just said, all right, the videos that are out there, they're okay, but they don't have as much impact. And if I was making a video, I would like it to have more impact. So here is my video. So I found that the best things to come out of this are just people looking at the information and doing something meaningful with it, because I think Jerry and I both sort of realized that we're up against the most powerful forces that run the planet, you know. So what do you do? I mean, these people have sophisticated weaponry, sophisticated technology. They know all about human psychology. They know about propaganda. And they have the global networks to manipulate people's mind through news media, through more internet-based media now too. Because, we could have long conversations about sites like InfoWars and these other sites, that also are controlled and do not... You would never get Jerry Leephart on InfoWars.com saying what he's just said. Correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry, but I don't believe you've ever been invited to speak on a site like InfoWars.com, have you, or...?
InfoWars, Alex Jones at one point actually set up a propaganda episode where he accused, quote, followers of Dr. Wood, unquote, of having been involved in some sort of street brawl right here in New York City. And it was at that point that We wrote to Alex Jones, basically asking or requiring that he cease and desist from that sort of thing.
How long ago, Jerry?
Oh, this was during the pendency of the case, actually. So it must have been 10 years ago. Okay. Yes, and we just didn't need that. We didn't need to be perceived as ruffians, or to be put in that context that made it easier to marginalize Dr. Wood and the work that we were trying to do. So we weren't going to stand for that.
And in a similar, but if I can just add to that, Jerry, something that happened to me in the UK, not quite as extreme as that Alex Jones episode, which I did write a little bit about at the time, I recall. I was involved with 9/11 truth groups in the UK. I'd realised that there was something fishy about them. And there's one particular person who is still, on the circuit doing the odd interview on, networks like InfoWars and stuff. She's called Annie Machon. She was a partner of David Shaler, who used to work for MI5, Military Intelligence, office in the UK. And I actually got to know David Shaler and Annie Machon. Because of that and their high profile, David Shaler was very famous in the UK. He was a bit like Daniel Ellsberg, if I was to liken him to somebody in the US, David Shaler was a little bit like Daniel Ellsberg, kind of. And so he was quite well known. Annie Machon was his partner. And I said to Annie Machon, Jerry Leephart, Dr. Wood, they started a 9/11 QI-TAM case. Please, when you do your public talks on 9/11, can you at least mention this case and what it's about? I didn't expect her to go into the detail that we've gone into because that wasn't her area of expertise. But I wanted her to mention this. I knew her. She stayed at my house, to raise knowledge of the case so that we would have more leverage with the people involved. She refused. She point blank refused because she said it was all speculation. I can't talk about cases which are based on speculation. I've got that in an email from her.
Which is untrue. She would have to prove that it's speculation.
Correct. I mean, we've talked about evidence. That was why Jerry originally contacted Dr. Wood, because it was exactly the opposite of speculation.
Right.
So Annie Machon, being an MI5 officer herself, who should be evaluating evidence as part of her job, she apparently doesn't work for them anymore, but this was the sort of resistance that we were facing. The people that should have been supporting us didn't support us. That was our experience, basically, wasn't it, Jerry? That was what we found, wasn't it?
That's correct. So the best that we could ever manage was sort of tacit or anonymous support. People were just unwilling, and I think for good reason, certainly for understandable reason, willing to raise their head to be associated with this, because It is a very difficult bit of reality to address. You almost want to believe in the official governmental nonsensical conspiracy theory
to get on with your life.
We're all pretty much programmed to go along and get along. That is the human condition.
But you have to read the book in order to really get a good sense of the irrefutable scientific evidence part. When you just talk about it, it seems incredibly improbable and exotic. So it takes a certain person to absorb this material and then relay that information. It took me a long time to really absorb this book, and Dr. Judy Wood really helped me along. If that didn't happen, it would have been difficult. Did you find that a similar path?
Well, the experience I had, the first bits of information that I saw that had been prepared by Judy Wood, it was a jaw-dropping experience for me. I was trained, my whole adult life as a lawyer to look at evidence and to distinguish what is evidence, what's admissible evidence, and what isn't. And I saw in the material that Dr. Wood was putting together a path through to being able to use admissible evidence. You know, some of this evidence, quite a bit of it, was going to be admissible. So that's what got me onto that path. And then I also, to this day, I marvel at Dr. Judy Wood's ability and capacity to engage in or to utilize a scientific methodology in coming to conclusions and in doing forensic work. She just, if you get to know her, you do appreciate the intellect, and I also will go a step further and call it genius.
I mean, I'll say that as well, because she quite often if you think you've thought of something clever, she's already thought of it and probably three things further ahead than that. You know, she's and I said to her last week, you're so far ahead of my thinking sometimes, you know, it just takes me half the time to catch up. And it's true, you know.
Yeah.
It must have been heartbreaking for you, for both of you, to see the way she was treated the last, I guess, 10, 12 years by the various 9/11 groups. And Jerry, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I've been called COINTELPRO so many times that...
You have? Why?
Yes, just for representing, Dr. Judy Wood. And it's just interesting the lengths that people were willing to go to try to discredit this work. I think the first time it happened in an organized way was, I think it might have actually been prior to the filing of the request for correction. And we were in Washington, D.C. for a press event at the National Press Club. And out of the blue, someone approached us and said, "We'd like to do a video interview with Dr. Wood." And I was representing her at that time, and so there really was a legal question: should this interview go forward?
Who was it?
Well, as it turns out, this is an interview conducted by someone who went by the name of Gregory
S. Jenkins out of the University of Maryland. Yeah.
Right. So this and for years afterwards, there was this reference. Did you see the Greg Jenkins video? As a way of discrediting Dr. Wood. Now, for our part, while the video did try to sandbag Judy, and it did misrepresent what she was saying. However, in the main, Judy was able, even in that video interview, to stick to the points that she was making, and to do so in a way that where you could say that certainly she did not embarrass herself in any way, and there was nothing that Greg Jenkins did that could be said to have resulted in a refutation of Judy Wood in any way. But yet this video and this name, to this day, you can hear people trot out the name Greg Jenkins and the Greg Jenkins video. No one, to my knowledge, has seen or heard from Greg Jenkins since.
That's right, and he did do work that was funded by the NSA. That was in one of his papers. He took a very long sabbatical from his academic research work, an unusually long sabbatical, so that raised certain questions. And yeah, I wrote an article about that, and that's one of the times where I was actually, getting involved with Dr. Judy Woo's research more and more, because I'd seen, and I know that, as Jerry has just said, that he was there when that happened, and there were some suspicious things about it, just the circumstances, because it was filmed in a room where they didn't have permission to use it, and the security guard moved them out of the room, didn't they? And and they had two cameras that they brought with them, and lights, and it was midnight as well when it was filmed, and Dr. Wood was accosted on her way to the restroom, and all kinds of strange things, that were going on then.
Wow. Jerry, you were there the whole time?
I was there for that event.
Okay, so sandbagged in that particular interview, were there other significant situations similar to that came up that you might recall?
Well, as we go forward, I might recall something. That was certainly a significant one. Jeff, a lot of what happened was also in the context of internet blogs and chat rooms and so-called 9/11 sites where this was basically played out. And you literally had entire blogs dedicated to an attempt to refute Dr. Judy Wood, attempts to confirm that she was, quote, COINTELPRO, and so was Andrew.
And it's almost impossible to do this if you know science. And so what it came down to, as she was pointing out, is a lot of name-calling.
Correct.
And defamation of character.
It's absolutely correct.
I mean, just to give you the other extreme, which I always think of as one of the extremes of what, as an example of what Jerry and I have been talking about, there is a video by a character called James Easton, where I think it's called Undoing the Damage to 9/11 Research by Dr. Judy Wood. It might not have her name in the title, but it's definitely got this concept of doing damage to 9/11 research in the title by James Easton. It's on his YouTube channel. It's a 15-minute video of him tearing up on camera a copy of Where Did the Towers Go? He literally tears it up on camera. Now, I've never seen a video of anybody tearing up any other book on camera. And as you know, it's a hardback book, so it's a pretty tough job.
And that's equivalent to book burning in a Nazi regime, or what they did to Wilhelm Reich,
his books.
Anybody with any sense could see it from that angle.
The even more unusual thing is that this James Easton character has made videos about 9/11 truth, the true story. So work that one out.
Dr. Wood said something. She was talking about the second net and how the arena was already set for the truth movement before 9/11 happened. And I thought that was interesting. Mm-hmm. Jerry, did you see that as significant?
Well, being as closely involved as I was, you could see that those who were denying the validity of Dr. Wood's case did appear to be organized. I never sought to make that a part of any case that I did or to prove it. It was there. You could see it. And whether they were actually paid informants or commentators of some kind. Yes, that's the way it seemed to me, but I'm not making any claims.
I have another clip of Dr. Judy Wood talking about Building 6 and engineers at that time. It was about 2006, I believe. Let's have a listen.
And actually, when they pulled down Building 6, the remains of it, yes, they pulled it with cables because they were afraid of damaging the bathtub wall. And that's only a six-story building.
Imagine if
a 110-story building crashed down.
It would have damaged the bathtub and then flooded lower Manhattan, as you point out.
The PATH train tunnels that go under the Hudson River come up at the base of the towers. And there was some water in the tunnels, but that was due to the fire hoses and open, you know, rainfall falling in there. Because once they pumped out the tunnels, they stayed dry. There was no leak, which is rather remarkable, considering those are built in the early 1900s.
And from there, you brought this to the attention of other people.
I brought this to the attention of a couple of people, but you get a very strong reaction from people that, you know, don't go there. It was making other people too uncomfortable, and if you're the only person talking about it, it becomes very difficult. The biggest thing I began with was the timing issue. If you imagine 9 out of every 10 floors is totally gone, we're overestimating the damage. You just had 1 out of every 10 floors, and then you go to, you know, collapse these, that one, the top floor gets, you know, 10 floors of picking up speed, and then as we saw, it just turns to dust, it goes splat. And then let's say that there is enough energy to start the next one moving. There isn't, but let's, you know, assume there is.
Okay.
And you do this kind of leapfrog thing, and you find out that would take 30 seconds. And if it went floor by floor, it's just the timing alone, it would take 100 seconds. And I actually presented this at an engineering conference in 2006. The folks in the audience at the end, you know, someone stood up, and these are engineers, stood up, pulled out his pocket watch, and said, "Run that video again. I want to time it." Somebody on the other side of the room said, "Okay, so it's not 10 seconds, it's 10.2 seconds, or it's 11.1 seconds. That's a long way away from 100 seconds. And the guy with the stopwatch got a sad look on his face, and jaw kind of dropped, and he goes, "You're right." And reluctantly put his pocket watch away and realized something here was wrong with the story.
Dr. Wood, I want to ask you about that specifically. What is it? Here we have engineers that had to get a watch and time it with the film, and this is 2006, 5 years later. Why does it take 5 years for this level of observation to occur?
Oh, and they wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't presented this at the conference. And you can imagine how scary it is. Like, you know, on that day when I was in the faculty conference room, watching the replays over and over again on the big screen TV in there, and looking around the room like, doesn't anyone else see what I'm seeing? And folks were so mesmerized and pulled in by whatever was going on. And I, for some reason, wasn't pulled in by it. Not used to, you know, watching television. You know, there's some kind of difference going on there. But I felt very, very alone. There was nobody I could talk to about this. They looked at me like I was crazy if I brought up the subject. And I think there was a lot of isolated pockets like that. Most people just kept quiet. You're ostracized. So you just keep your mouth
that
shut and put your head down
them.
And
yeah.
Go back to doing your work. And assume, like I said, like the grown-ups were going to take care of it. You assume that some agency somewhere, it's somebody else's job to look into it.
The grown-ups didn't take care of it necessarily in the sense that she's talking about. And she actually had to be the grown-up in this case. She's referencing these engineers at this event. And, Andrew, what do you think about that, the way they were... They were really not paying attention, even back in 2006, to the timing of it. It would have been 100
right.
seconds.
Right. I mean, this is something which really switched me on initially was when I saw the timing explained in another video, and the free fall issue is, or shouldn't really call it free fall, but the time of destruction, which you can sort of loosely describe as free fall. That's what alerted me to the problem. And so many people, I have another friend, for example, who I reference when I tell these stories. He teaches chemistry at a high school, as you would call it, a secondary school. And he would not look. I'd known this chap for 30 years, you know, and he would not look at it. He would not look at it. I tried to have a conversation.
Willful blindness.
Right.
Indeed. Yeah, or cognitive dissonance. You know, Jeff, I do have to leave momentarily, but I would not want to leave without sending a greeting to Dr. Judy Wood, who I understand might be listening to this program. And you know, once again, I will say, as I have many times, It was one of the singularly most important opportunities I had as a practicing lawyer to represent, work with, and get to know Dr. Judy Wood. That was an honor and privilege of the first magnitude in my life.
Well, Attorney Jerry Lephart, thank you for being on In Other News. And Andrew, thank you for bringing him here. I really appreciate that as well.
An honor for me, too.
Yeah, it's just been a pleasure speaking with you. And thanks
you,
for standing up when you did at the right time. And it's on record.
It is.
So we really, really appreciate this.
Thank you.
Well, we're going to be switching gears just a little bit and talking about some of the other research that Andrew has been involved with. And that includes geoengineering and Agenda 21. But before we do that, I want to mention you're tuned in to WBAI FM New York City. And this is a special two-hour broadcast of In Other News. I'm Jeff Brady. We were speaking with Jerry Lephart, who represented Dr. Judy Wood during her Ketem case 10 years ago. And our guest here is Andrew Johnson, who brought Dr. Judy Wood to the UK to do a lot of her presentations. And listeners, I want to remind you that those presentations were videotaped and then put on DVD, and then Andrew was kind enough to make really good copies of them, send them to me, and we used them as premiums for raising money for this station. And so, Andrew, thank you for doing that. That was really cool. You responded right away, and I think you sent the irrefutables out to
right,
me.
Right, I think well. We, yeah, I think maybe previously, I think we've done it twice over the years, mm-hmm. and one time was the one of the talks that we had in the UK and one which was in Holland, in the Netherlands, and then the second one was, as you say, the irrefutable film, which I referred to earlier. And people can still get copies of that off me. I know some people don't use the internet much, but if they can, you know, get to a public library, get over to the website, I send the DVDs out for free, you know, so if they haven't got a lot of money, I'm willing to send them over. You know, I'm not wealthy, but I'm not poor, kind of thing. You know, so I do send the DVDs out to people that want them.
One thing Dr. Wood would point out in her presentations, and there's a whole chapter of it in her book, is Hurricane Erin. If you would tell listeners about that hurricane, why it's important in context of her book.
Absolutely, this is one of the very key areas which